Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
So the theme for tonight is happiness, and I thought that we could just begin by consulting our experience. Because whatever we do for happiness. And so whether we're conscious of it or unconscious of it, we're always tending in a kind of happy direction, or at least what we take to be a happy direction. So many of you are students at the University of South Florida. You probably didn't come here for the excellent football team. That's just been a pleasant surprise this year. You probably came here to obtain a degree, and if somebody were to ask you, like, why are you studying biology, or why are you studying medicine, or why are you studying nursing science, you'd say something along the lines of, because I'd like to work in the field. And then if somebody were to ask you, well, why do you want to work in the field? You'd say, I don't know, it's the type of thing that maybe I'm well suited to, or it earns a significant salary, or it's the type of thing with which I can provide for myself and maybe for other people as well. It's like, okay, well, why do you want to do that? Well, I mean, I'd like to get married. I'd like to have a family. I'd like to live a peaceful life and maybe buy a piece of property like on a laguna and occasionally spend some time floating, hopefully not in the near vicinity of animals that'll eat me. And then I might ask you further, like, why do you want to do that? And at the end of the day, you're going to arrive at something along the lines of, I mean, because I want to be happy. So all of us do what we do because we want to be happy. The question is whether we do it well or whether we do it in such a way that actually leads to true happiness. So part of the, I suppose, motivation for tonight's lecture is to discern as to what constitutes true happiness and then how we can organize our lives so that in patterning them on true happiness, they might prove blessed indeed. Okay, so I have 5 points. I don't know if I should share with you the topic sentences of my points because some of them are relatively obscure. You know how sometimes when you make notes, they're just notes to yourself? And then, like, you're trying to communicate to other people what you were writing in class, and you're like, it's better that you don't. So point number one is metaphysical basis. I'm sure that sounds sexy. Whoa! We got some metaphysics fans out there. Holy smokes! And then point two is candidates for happiness. Point three, you didn't see this coming, is return to the metaphysical basis. And then point four is access to happiness, and point five is managing expectations. So I hope that's perfectly unclear, because it was intended to be. Let's get about the business of clarifying things. Okay, so let's talk about the metaphysical basis of happiness. We talk sometimes, especially in Christian circles or Catholic circles, about nature. I suppose many people talk about nature, but we're typically talking about nature in an ever so slightly different way. And sidebar, I'm going to step to the right whenever I say things that are mildly impertinent, but I can't help myself. So you'll find that often enough it's Christians or Catholics who are the sole defenders of reasonable things or reasonable discourse. You know, like Chesterton, he has a line from like the 1920s. He's like, there's going to be a time where you're going to get martyred for saying that the grass is green. And at the time, it's like, oh man, that guy, he's being hyperbolic. But here we are in 2025. Okay, stepping back center. So when we say nature, we typically mean that like a thing has a kind of thingness to it. You're like, wow, this guy said he was going to clarify things, and now he's talking about thingness. Where is this going? I mean that there's a kind of integrity, there's a kind of coherence, there's a kind of interior and exterior logic to the things which we encounter here on the surface of the earth. And what we observe is that that provides the basis or the standard for how that thing is meant to be. Okay, now I'm going to give you some examples. So, like rocks have a rocky nature, and they attain to their fulfillment as rocks as a mere matter of gravitation. And plants have a planty nature, and they attain to their fulfillment as a mere matter of biology. And animals have an animally nature, and they attain to their fulfillment as a mere matter of instinct. But the basic idea is that when you can identify what a thing is, it gives some indication as to how that thing is meant to act or meant to live, or just in general, meant to be. Okay? So it's on the basis of our access to reality that we can make claims about how reality ought to be. And some of you are hearing this are like, does he know about the naturalistic fallacy? I do. I just don't grant it. So, we'll talk about that later. Okay. Now, all we have observed to this point is that things are so constituted and being so constituted that gives indication as to how they ought to live or how they ought to act or how they ought to be. So obviously we're leading somewhere, and that's to our human nature. We have a human nature. And on account of that fact, there are certain ways in which we ought to comport ourselves and certain ways in which we ought not to comport ourselves. But if we're being honest, it's kind of complicated sorting out exactly what we ought to do. And in part, that's because we have a complex nature. So rocks, I mean, there's not much going on there in the way of complexity. It's just a rock. You can expend your energy trying to determine whether it's, let's see if I remember this from seventh grade, igneous, sedimentary, or metamorphic rock. Thank you. I'm feeling good about myself. If you would like to hear further specification of igneous rock, I'll be over here talking about obsidian and pumice. But on account of the fact that you don't want that, I'll keep going about human nature. Okay, so we have a complex nature in that we have both body and soul. All right, so we live at the horizon of creation as sharing with material creation in its situatedness and in sharing with the spiritual world in something of its infinite aspiration. So there's a kind of question as to how we ought to live, because some things are relatively straightforward. Okay, so like on account of the fact that we have these type of teeth, we ought to treat them in a certain way. All right, so I'm one of those people that really likes to brush my teeth hard because it feels great. But I've been told that that's neither good for your enamel nor for your gums. And so here I am at the supermarket buying myself another soft bristle toothbrush, even though that feels weak to me. You know, it's kind of like limp-wristed soft bristle toothbrush. Because my teeth and my gums are the way that they are, I ought to treat them in such a way that leads to their flourishing rather than to their demise. Gum recession is a thing. I'm learning this. It just happens to people when they get old. Apparently there are things that you can do to precipitate it, but like, I just discovered that my teeth live pretty close to, like, I was like, wow, wild. Okay, so, I made an emergency call to a dentist. I was like, I just never noticed how close my teeth are to, like, being exposed. He's like, yeah, people typically don't notice until they notice, and then they typically freak out, and then they typically call me. I was like, cool, I pertain to a great tradition. All right, so when it comes to treating teeth, it's fairly straightforward how you treat them well. Now, things might get complicated if you have like gingivitis or periodontitis, but we'll get into that later. And by later, I mean never. But it's a little less clear as to what we ought to do with our spirit, right? Because when you deal with an invisible world, it's kind of hard to verify as to what's good and what's not good, or as to what's better and what's not better. Okay, so then let's entertain some candidates as to what constitutes the way we ought to treat our human nature so as to secure its flourishing. That's a somewhat complicated sentence, but like, what ought we to live for? Okay, what ought we to live for? So you saw in the very long title to this talk that I've given you some ideas. I'm always of the mind that if you can't choose between the title and the subtitle, just make them both the title, all right? Especially in the age of SEO, it's always good to have a lot of words that are very searchable. Okay, so what are people out there saying? Or maybe better, how are people out there living? What kind of indication do they give with their concrete choices as to what they care about? So I thought that the first candidate we could entertain is money. Spoiler alert, I'm about to rule this out. I don't know about you, but I personally chose my avocation for the money. Actually, they did a study at one point. I mean, like, you don't have to do too terribly deep of a study, but they did years of education versus remuneration. Okay, so x-axis, years of education, y-axis, remuneration. Like, the worst possible, priest. Devastating, you know? Next worst, for those of you who are looking for jobs, architect. Okay, so prayerfully consider that as an option for your future. So money, maybe it's the case that we are made for money. Maybe that's what represents our ultimate fulfillment. St. Thomas Aquinas has practically no patience for this. For those of you who have your Summa on hand, this is Prima Secundae, question 2, article 1. If I see like little book lights come on at this stage of the game, I'll know that the nerds are about. I brought plenty of book lights. Okay. So they were here. Okay. So St. Thomas says, well, let's consider artificial wealth and then natural wealth. By natural wealth, he means like food, drink, clothing, shelter, the types of things which enrich us in our bodily nature. But he says, all right, we're talking about artificial wealth in the terms of like money or currency. He says the thing about that, right, artificial wealth, is that it's for natural wealth. Okay, the reason that you accumulate money or currency is so that you have purchase power, but purchase power is ultimately poised for purchase. So this can't possibly be the end of our lives because it refers us to something else. Don't confuse this for a sidebar, even though I've stepped to the right. All right, so then he says, what about natural wealth? Well, he says, on account of the fact that our bodily condition is limited, there are certain limits to the amount of natural wealth that we can meaningfully consume or use. That's like a long way of saying, like, even if you think that your life is about the consumption of Chick-fil-A, you probably max out at like 9 spicy chicken sandwiches a day. Because beyond 9, it starts to get uncomfortable, okay? And like, again, you might think that Chick-fil-A is the very substance of your flourishing, but you're gonna have to reckon with the fact that after about 15 minutes, the quality of the fries, it really starts to decline. Okay, so you're going to see in the limitations of this material thing a kind of indication that it can't possibly bear the whole weight of our heart's longing. Because it's not the type of thing which admits of infinite consumption. It's just the limitations of our bodily nature suggest that we can only consume these things to a limited extent. Okay, so it's not money. If you're following along with the talk title, we're now going to move on to pleasure. St. Thomas has another argument whereby to dismiss pleasure as the end of life. Because he says, the thing about pleasure is that pleasure accompanies the attainment of something else. That sounds somewhat complicated. But the basic idea is this. Maybe you've heard of Aristotle's threefold distinction of the good. He says there are useful goods, there are pleasant goods, and there are what he calls honest goods, or noble goods. We might even say beautiful, wonderful goods. The types of goods around which we seek to congregate and share our lives with those whom we love. Okay. Now, when we're talking about pleasant goods, he says, in effect, what we are describing is the experience of attaining to an honest good or a noble good. So when you arrive at something that's worthwhile, when you arrive at something that represents an end, there is a certain pleasure that accompanies that experience. And if we go back to our first point, this is actually baked into nature. God has made it such that you experience pleasure when doing the types of things which conduce to your perfection. That's an overly complicated sentence. Basically, God has reaffirmed good activity by imparting pleasure. Okay, so like, when you eat, you experience it as pleasurable. That is by design, because if you don't eat, you will perish, all right? When one engages in sexual intercourse, he or she experiences it as pleasurable. That is by design, because if the human race were not to engage in sexual intercourse, it would perish in a single generation. So God has seen fit to impart pleasure to the type of activity which secures our flourishing. All right, we've already found a way by which to dismiss this, though, as the end of life, because pleasure is the type of thing that accompanies our realization of the good. It is not itself our realization of the good. All right, there are people in the ancient world who thought that was the case. We call them hedonists. And there are people in the contemporary world who live as such, but they know, at a certain level, that their pursuit is vain. Because pleasure can't, again, bear the weight of our whole heart's desire. So then, my third and final candidate, at least false candidate, spoiler alert, there is going to be a true candidate, and his name is Jesus. Okay, third and final candidate is influence. Now, influence is a somewhat complex word because it can cover any number of things, but just think about influencers. Okay, apparently, I'm like shocked by so many things here under the sun, but Jonathan Haidt in that book, The Anxious Generation, he says that this generation was asked as to like, what would you like to be when you grew up? And the plurality of respondents said, an influencer. It's fascinating. Or at least here in the United States, the plurality of respondents said an influencer. I think in China, a plurality of respondents still said astronaut. That's awesome. Imagine a world in which you still wanted to be an astronaut. There is that world. It's on the other side of the globe. Okay. All right, so when we think about influence, we think about it, one, in terms of like honor, glory, fame, notoriety, right? To be an influencer is to be seen, right? It's to be known and loved in some way, shape, or form. But it's also to wield power, all right? Because then people will approach you with their products. They're like, hey, I've got this new medium bristle toothbrush that doesn't actually destroy your enamel or make your gums recede. And so you can just plow away at your teeth and get all that scrubby feel, and it's actually going to be good for you. You're like, bro, I'm going to sell this product. So on account of the fact that you are an influencer, people approach you for their various purposes, whether nefarious or otherwise salubrious. You were hoping that the word salubrious would come up in this talk. I knew you were. I was too. Okay. All right, so influence, in terms of like honor, glory, fame, the problem with that, I mean, the reason for which it can't constitute the final end of life, is because honor, glory, and fame, they're in the other person. They're the types of things with another person attributes to you. And influencers all know that it can be fickle. For those of you who watch K-pop Demon Hunters, let's go. You know that all that it takes is an onstage breakup of the trio for you to plummet on the charts from first to eighth, okay? So all you have to do is say something silly on the internet and all of a sudden, your honor, glory, fame have diminished in market fashion. I don't know if we cancel people still, but like that could happen. At least it could in like 2019. keep going, Gregory. Okay, so that can't constitute the end of life because it's in someone else. It's too fragile, it's too volatile, it's too fickle. What about the power? Well, the thing about power is that power is for another. All right, you can think about this in terms of the hierarchy of the church. What is the reason for which men are ordained? So that they can lord it over the laity? Look at me in my cool clothes. No, it's so that they can serve. All right, it's so that in configuration with our Lord Jesus Christ, they can lay down their lives for their friends. All right, they as pastors can lay down their lives for their sheep. So the purpose of power is service. All right, so ultimately it terminates in something else. So all of our candidates have turned out to be false. Fear not, we have arrived at point three, that best titled point, return to the metaphysical basis. I love that guy in the back who's like, I'm going to cheer every time he says metaphysical. Okay. All right. We talked about rocks. We talked about plants. We talked about animals. We kind of talked about human beings, but I like to talk about human beings a little bit more. Because what is it about us that differentiates us from the rest of material creation? Well, what differentiates us from the rest of material creation is that we are made to the image and likeness of God, to use the biblical language taken from Genesis 1. All right? If we want to get a little more philosophical about it, we can say that, like in plants, we observe certain activities, like nutrition and growth and reproduction. In animals, we observe further activity, like sense cognition and sense appetition and locomotion. But in human beings, we observe yet more dignified activity, namely knowing and loving. All right? And not just any kind of knowing and loving, but spiritual knowing and loving. Which is to say, we have a spirit. We have a rational soul, which gives rise to the powers of intellect and will, which constitute us as made to the image and likeness of God. And the Christian tradition will ask, what does it mean to be made to the image and likeness of God? And they will respond, to be capable of communion with God. Basically, we can know and love God with his own knowledge and love of himself. Pretty awesome. It's pretty dignified. All right. So, when we look closer at our spiritual powers, what we observe is that they go beyond our sensitive powers, that they range much further and farther. So like, for instance, your sense cognition or your sense appetition, here we're talking about like, you know, five external senses and then internal senses, if you ever talked about those, whatever, moving on. But then also like the passions that arise from your engagement with your sense experience, those things are all limited to this or that object. In the sense that, like you approach something that seems delicious to you. I've already talked about Chick-fil-A, so I have to talk about something else that I like, Chex Muddy Buddies. You know how you have those foods eating? It's like cookie dough for some people until your mom like slaps you on the back of the hand and says, salmonella is a thing. No one knows what it is, but it's a real threat. Well, for me, it's Chex Muddy Buddies. It's like I see it, and then all of a sudden I wake up in a gutter just covered in powdered sugar. It's like, holy smokes, how did I get in this gutter? It's incredible. Yeah, so they sell Chex Muddy Buddies at DCA, which is one of the three airports in the Washington metro area. But they recently increased the price of a little bag of Chex Muddy Buddies to like $7.49. So I'm like struggling, you know, like in good conscience. Like, can I have this every time? Because when I would go to the airport, my lunch used to be two peanut butter, like those refrigerated energy bars, protein bars, the peanut butter ones. You know those ones that I'm talking about? They're sometimes really stale and sometimes really delicious. And then two bags of Chex Muddy Buddies. And then I'd get on the plane like a grown man, just like eating out of a bag. People would be like, what's wrong with you? I'd be like, I just love them. But that costs $22. So I was like, bro, I got to get myself something else. Okay. There's also a Chick-fil-A at the airport. Okay, so things are looking up. But while our sense powers are limited to just this or that thing, our spiritual powers are not limited to this or that thing. Our spiritual powers have a kind of infinite scope. Perhaps you've heard this line from St. Augustine from the Confessions, our hearts are restless. I'll give you the latter half.
Oh yeah, you anticipated. Paola, she is ready.
Okay, so our hearts have a kind of restlessness insofar as they don't experience here on the surface of the earth something adequate to their inquiry, all right? So like our minds are always looking further and our hearts are always searching or groping even more ardently. And the reason for which is that, as the rest of the quote goes, our hearts are restless until they rest in God. Which is to say, by virtue of the fact that we have these spiritual powers, intellect and will, with an infinite scope or an infinite range, they will never be satisfied until such time as they encounter and rest in an infinite object. And there's only one on offer. And like I spoiled at the beginning, his name is Jesus. Which is to say, God. Okay, so There's a 20th century author named Yves Simon who is friends with Jacques Maritain, if you're into that type of thing. And he said, this accounts really for our freedom. The reason for which you are free to choose amongst different good things here on the surface of the earth is in part because none of them will wholly satisfy you. He says, we are underdetermined with respect to created goods because we are superdetermined to the uncreated good. So by virtue of the fact that you will only ever be satisfied with God, you will never be satisfied with anything else. I don't often quote poetry, but when I do, I step to the right. Okay, so there was a 16th, 17th century Anglican divine named George Herbert who wrote a poem called The Pulley. I once encountered this in the back of the Breviary. I don't know if you know. The four-volume Breviary, which is about to be replaced, has like a little appendix. Well, it has several appendixes, one of which is poetry. Totally random. Some of them are great. Some of them are not great. But he describes God's, as it were, deliberation whilst creating man. And he says, I mean, he gives a kind of introduction, I'm not going to quote the whole thing. But when God at first made man, a glass of blessings standing by, let us, said he, bestow upon him all we can, let the world's riches which dispersed lie contract into a span. So strength first made a way, then beauty flowed, then wisdom, honor, pleasure. When almost all was out, God made a stay, perceiving that alone of all his treasure, rest at the bottom lay. For if I should, said he, bestow this jewel also on my creature, he would adore my gifts instead of me, and rest in nature, not the God of nature. So both should losers be. So let him keep the rest, but keep them with repining restlessness. Let him be rich and weary, that if goodness lead him not, yet weariness may toss him to my breast. The point of which is that God has given us all manner of good things. He has broken us open to the possibility of infinite longing, and there is a corresponding good. But the result of that is that while we live in the here and now, we will be vexed with a certain restlessness. Because, again, we will never encounter anything here on the surface of the earth by which we will be wholly satisfied. Because we're built different. All right? So as you can see, everything comes back to the return to the metaphysical basis. All right. Thank you. I appreciate that. I feel like I should step to the left because now we're going to do some theology. Up until this point, we've been doing mostly philosophy. But I don't want to stand here too long, so I'm going to go back to the center. So if it is the case that we are made for God, you might ask yourself, okay, cool. Well, how do I get God? Most of you know how to get God. I realize that get God sounds a little bit crass, but I want to be concrete in my formulation. Lest you think that the Christian life is about maintaining a respectful distance and telling God that he's nice on occasion. It's not. It's about living with Him. It's living in Him. It's being transformed unto yet more perfectly the image and likeness of the Most High God. It's becoming a partaker of His nature. But the fact of the matter is, we can only know God, as it were, through a glass darkly until such time as He makes Himself known. We rely upon His revelation and His mediation of grace if we are going to attain to Him. Thanks be to God, He has made ways, or He has opened a way for us. And this is what we mean when we talk about the access granted to us by the theological virtues. Okay, so this is the point of faith, hope, and charity. Namely, that it gives you access to God, genuine access to God. It's not like it equips you with a kind of vocabulary and grammar whereby you can speak metaphorically about God, or whereby you can like rattle off cute theological poetry about God, but never actually commune with Him. No, it's about communion. With faith, you attain to God. With hope, you attain to God. With charity, you attain to God. A kind of shorthand version of this that one of my students came up with this year in class was, faith attains to God as truthful. Hope attains to God as helpful. And charity attains to God as He is in Himself. All right, charity just attains to God as God is. All right, so if we are to attain to this end, if we are to arrive at the happiness which lies in store by the embrace of an infinite good which corresponds to our infinite nature, then we will need to receive indication as to who this one is and how He seeks to transform our lives. And that's precisely what faith does. Faith gives us access to God's testimony. God who can neither deceive nor be deceived. God who gives us certainty about Himself, about His very life, and all things in light thereof. So faith makes it such that we can actually abide in the things that God reveals. Next, hope. Hope gives us the wherewithal to travel that road, which is to say, to attain to the goal as faith reveals it. Now, what we clue into faith, or the way by which faith clues into God, is specifically in identifying the fact that He is omnipotent and that He is merciful. All right, so God makes promises, and all of us are tempted to think that those promises are kind of vague and inapplicable. But what hope does is it convicts us at our core that those promises are for us. For each of us, that God doesn't just say things because He wants to make us feel good. God says things because He intends to bring the change about. And the change in this case is your salvation. So faith has for its object God as helpful, which is to say God as beatifying, God who gives Himself to us for our enjoyment. All right? And hope is going to have to sustain us along the journey because, as we have said, we are just riddled with dissatisfaction. And there are various approaches that people take when they register their dissatisfaction. Some people are like, all right, I approached this concrete good and that concrete good and the other concrete good and none of them satisfied me. So maybe I'll just keep looking for different concrete goods for the entirety of my life. All right, that's the kind of unthinking hedonist. Not to like cast aspersions. It's just to say that people are unwilling to face the fact that none of these things wholly correspond and they can live an entire life in that rut. All right. Another type of person says, listen, I've been burned once or twice by limited created goods, and I'm just not going to play the game, all right? Because I don't want to get exposed, or I don't want to appear dopey or foolish before my peers. And so I'm just going to foreclose on the possibility that the desires of my heart actually have a corresponding good. So I'll just distance myself from the whole of it, all right? There's a third option. If we haven't encountered the good here on the surface of the earth, that must mean that it exists somewhere else. And it does. It exists in heaven. And again, His name is Jesus. All right? So the idea here is that the Christian has the wherewithal by faith and hope to orient his or her gaze on high so as to conduct his or her steps unto the end. Third and finally, charity. The good thing about charity is that charity just is the arrival. There's nothing beyond charity. All right? St. Augustine has this cool distinction between using and enjoying. He says that we use means and that we enjoy ends. And the basic point is that, if we're being honest, God can only be enjoyed because God is the end among ends. God is the ultimate end of all of our longing. And if we end up using God, we're in a strange set of circumstances. Weird application. This should inform the way in which we offer prayer of petition. Sometimes we approach God in such a way as to seemingly want something more than God. It's like we go to God so that he can solve our like gastric distress. It's like, what I really want is just quiet bowels, all right? So I'm gonna use God to the end of bowel quietation. But at the end of the day, I don't think that that should be our posture. That shouldn't be our approach. We should come before God cognizant of the fact that he is a loving father and that he kind of wants to spoil us. He kind of wants to spoil us, his children. And that we appeal to him for indications, tokens of his love. But at the end of the day, we will always and everywhere be satisfied with him. And that if we don't get gastric quietation, or if we don't get material wealth, or if we don't get whatsoever other good we pray for, we will have still had enough. Because we will have had God. And at the end of the day, the only thing that Christ promises is God. That's it. That's all he promises. He doesn't promise you anything else. Nothing. That got really dark, but nothing. All right? It's like, wow, who hurt him? All right. So, no one, I'm fine. All right, so the thing about charity is that you arrive at God for God's sake. So like with faith, you arrive at God and you're like, hey, tell me what's up. And then with hope, you arrive at God and you're like, hey, give me the goods. Now the goods being God himself. But with charity, check this out. You arrive at God and you're just like, and that's it for all eternity. You're just pumped out of your mind because you're in the presence of your beloved friend. To whom you will the good as to yourself, recognizing in him a subject of attribution, recognizing in him in some wild way one like unto yourself who is capable of an interpersonal communion, a confluence of thought and feeling which can last unto ages of ages, which is wild. So that's happiness. Charity just is happiness, and the fact of the matter is you can begin to experience it now. Because while faith and hope pass away in heaven, charity abides. Charity abides, and it's the very same charity. St. Catherine of Siena kind of says, not really, but she kind of says, all the way to heaven is heaven. In the sense that what we experience here and now has a kind of continuity with what we await in the life to come. It's not just an exercise in delayed gratification. Mind you, he will wipe away every tear from your eyes. There will be no death or mourning, no sorrow and pain. That'll be awesome, all right? But you will be able to recognize it in the sense that you will have lived towards it as a Christian. C.S. Lewis says, at the end, we will look back at our time on earth and we'll recognize it. For those who end up in hell, they'll recognize their time on earth to have been hell on earth. For those who end up in heaven, they'll look back at their time on earth and recognize it to have been heaven on earth. This is heaven on earth. Because by virtue of the love which God has poured into our hearts, we are capable of communion with him and all those whom he entrusts to us, which is the whole point of life. All right, the checklists are nice. The various discrete tasks are nice, but they're ultimately all done in service of communion. They're all done for people, because that's the type of thing that we are. That's our nature. Our nature is built for communion. So then, fifth and final point, managing expectations. It's gonna take some time. All right, we've made comparison to rocks, to plants, to animals. You're thinking to yourself, there's another kind of creature that you've left out to this point, Father Gregory. I was saving it to the last. All right, let's talk a little bit about angels. Angels attain to their end by one movement. Basically, they're created in grace and they have an opportunity to say, let's go, or I don't think so. And that's it. And then they just, as it were, live that choice for the rest of eternity. Angels attain to their end by one movement. We, as human beings, attain to our end, not by one. Not by two, not by three, but by like a billion movements, all right? St. Thomas says many movements, all right? We attain to our end by many movements. The road is long. I'm not gonna quote Rascal Flatts. Here we go. So the road is long and often wearisome, all right? It's sad and it just takes for freaking ever, which is tough, all right? And we can, as Christians, be honest and say it's tough. All right, so when I say manage our expectations, does that mean that we should kind of curl up in a ball and just wait until dawn? No, but it does mean to say that you as a human being, by virtue of the fact that you are one, built for communion, and two, meant to experience it in a body, are vulnerable. You are going to get hurt. You're gonna get hurt, which is awful. And you might say to yourself, like, why this way? Why not make me a rock? Why not make me a plant? Why not make me an animal? Why not make me an angel? And the answer is, because God in his infinite wisdom saw fit to make you this type of thing, because he wanted his glory told forth in this type of thing, and he wanted to afford you a share in his divine life in this type of thing. And we can quibble. or we can just get down to the serious business of living. So, it's going to take a while, and it's going to hurt. And the fact of the matter is that present we are not yet there, or at least not yet there perfectly. But if we are to attain to it perfectly, St. Thomas says that we are responsible for referring our life to God and willing a higher state. If you want to keep two little kind of precepts before yourself as you kind of proceed from this event tonight, keep those two things before yourself. One, all right, refer it to God. That means you don't have to, like, physically, emotionally, psychologically, you don't have to feel good about your life. But what you do have to do is you have to refer it to God, not simply for Band-Aids or not simply for kind of magical transformation, but with the confidence that in some way, shape, or form, God has something to say about it and that God will in some way pour his love into it. All right, your body's going to keep breaking down. Your mind's going to go to pieces. You're just going to, like, live the last 4 years of your life wearing adult diapers. It's going to be devastating, you know? But the fact of the matter is you can refer your life to God from start to finish, irrespective of how well you've slept, irrespective of how integral your family is, irrespective of how well your relationships have gone to this point. You can refer your life to God. And two, you can will a higher state. Not as a kind of ambition, like, look at me doing great things, but as a kind of act of certainty and confidence that God, who has begun a good work in you, will see it to completion. That he made you precisely for happiness, and he intends to realize his happy designs in his own way. And we don't know. Like, we just, sometimes we think that God's playing our game. He's not playing our game. We're playing his game, but we're still learning the rules. And the fact of the matter is, I still don't even know half of them. It's just wild. It's like, that's what you're doing? That's insane. That's totally crazy. Okay. So I think that if we want to put assign a particular word to happiness in the here and now, I'm going to give you this word, fit. Find your fit. Find a place where you fit. It doesn't have to be especially grandiose. It doesn't have to be better by comparison, but it has to be yours. And you can live there with the certainty and the confidence that God will continue to love you and that you can in due course love him back and love those whom he has entrusted to your care. So, as we observed at the outset, whatever we do for happiness. And I think that ultimately, to be in pursuit of happiness with upright heart means to refer everything to God and to will a higher state, confident that God who has begun a good work in us will see it to completion. Because ultimately, eye has not seen, nor ear heard, nor has it so much as dawned on the heart of man what God has ready for those who love him. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.